frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on May 15th, 2017, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Greg joined me to talk about the Senate Democrats' blueprint to rebuild America's infrastructure, and Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro's bill to create a National Infrastructure Development Bank. All that is coming up just ahead. Arsenal for Democracy is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line again this week, after several weeks off, is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on again.
How's Idaho doing these days?
Well, we're making the national and international news for all the wrong reasons, as per usual.
And joining us on the line from Virginia is Greg. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Bill. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
So we're going to start off by talking this week about infrastructure in the United States and how much we need to spend on it and how we should be spending on it, both as a long-term proposition and to get things back on track, since we have a pretty crumbly infrastructure that needs a lot of work before we even get to the sort of longer-term projects and development. Interestingly, there was a news story ahead of President Trump's upcoming visit to Saudi Arabia, which that's a whole problem for its own reasons, but that's, you've heard past episodes on that, I'm sure, and we'll talk about that separately. But as part of that kind of open bribing program that the Saudis engage in, they were saying they were going to give the United States, or invest, probably, I should say, not give, invest, for the purposes of making money off of it, $40 billion in U.S. infrastructure, which is not that much. That's like a drop in the bucket in terms of the infrastructure needs of the United States, as we will discuss. But it is certainly like back in the news that there is this, you know, proposed investment. And then Trump also had said that he was, you know, maybe going to do a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. But his infrastructure plan was, of course, based almost entirely on like federal tax cuts and tax credits, which structurally tends to favor projects that were basically already going to happen anyway from the private sector, but this would just kind of lower the cost of them or speed them up or whatever. And that doesn't really address the sort of gaping needs in terms of public infrastructural needs that are not going to be handled by the private sector. And it's an important thing to keep in mind throughout most of the discussion that we're going to have today and in general on infrastructure, that very rarely can it be handled by the private sector. Infrastructure is one of those things in society that costs a lot to build, it costs a lot to maintain, and you can't really get the money back very easily directly through usage fees or various taxes on transit or ticket prices, things like that, or tolls, because if you do that, then people don't really want to use them. And in general, it just, you know, you can make back some of it maybe through a nominal, you know, ticket on the train or a nominal, you know, toll or something, but you're really never going to make back the full cost. And that's fine, because we're making a investment as a society and as a country in the kind of setup that we want to have, and the resources that we want to have. And one of the resources that we have in this country is our infrastructure. And it's called infrastructure because it means that it's below the rest of the structure. So it's what's keeping up everything in the economy. So with that $40 billion number in our heads from the paltry Saudi investment proposal, I want to talk instead about the Senate Democrats' proposal that was floated early on, I think, in January, which so far, you know, hasn't really gained traction, but would be a good idea. And this is something that's very, very broadly supported. So, you know, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Pat Leahy, Bernie Sanders, there's a wide range of people that are on board with this. And this is, you can find this by Googling it. It's on the DPCC caucus sub website of the Senate website. And it's called A Blueprint to Rebuild America's Infrastructure. Rachel, this is an issue that I know is near and dear to your heart as it is to mine. And as I mentioned, we've got a very crumbly infrastructure. What is the estimated cost, according to the experts, of how much this country would need to spend just to get things back to like a normal level of repair?
So the American Society of Civil Engineers says that we should be spending $1.6 trillion above current levels just to get to a good state. So we are dealing with the effects of our infrastructure right now, and if we don't make those investments, it's just going to get worse and worse before it becomes a devastating issue.
Right, and you know, we've seen bridges literally collapsing under cars. That happened in, I think it was Minneapolis, quite a few years back now at this point. We've seen some pretty spectacular videos in the past several months from Atlanta, which has a very extensive highway system, of just sort of sections on fire and collapsing and things like that. It's not a pretty situation with our infrastructure, potentially costing lives, but certainly also just costing massive economic damage. So as Rachel said, $1.6 trillion is the number to reach. Unfortunately, this pretty good Senate Democrats proposal is only $1 trillion, but only $1 trillion, I think, scares a lot of politicians, that phrase. So the other thing, too, is that they keep emphasizing about jobs. Greg, did you want to talk a little bit about that angle just briefly?
Sure. The subheader of the Blueprint to Rebuild America's Infrastructure is literally creating over 15 million new jobs. And as we were discussing this before we started recording the radio show, I think that all of us had a bit of some qualms about this framing, let's say, because a lot of these jobs wouldn't be permanent in the same sense that it's probably spurious to say that the Keystone Pipeline creates jobs, because those jobs wouldn't be permanent. They're construction jobs, and once the construction is done, then it's over. So this framework of creating jobs, yes, jobs are important, but our nation's infrastructure is so bad that it's unsafe and unnavigable for, is that a word, navigable, for most Americans. I mean, even if you live in, an area like I do in the District of Columbia, our infrastructure is crumbling over here as well. And so the primary impetus, I think, behind doing a public infrastructure project, while it would be nice to create jobs, and would be nice to create permanent jobs too, which this doesn't necessarily do, or it doesn't certainly necessarily create 15 million permanent jobs. The reason that this is necessary is because we need to have like a functional society. And in order to have a functional society, we have to have this infrastructure, this backbone in which we can do things like go to hospitals and go to school and participate in politics and go to work and all these different things that were dependent upon an actual operating infrastructure, which, as you've mentioned, 6 weeks ago, we saw I-85 collapse and going into Atlanta, Georgia. And it only today is Monday the 15th that we're recording this, and it only just reopened today. So this is a problem. We essentially invested in infrastructure in a massive way in this country during the Great Society, and we never really did it again, and we really need to.
I think historically the big investments were there was a period of sort of road and highway construction and canal construction in the early 19th century. There was the Transcontinental Railroad received a lot of governmental support, although it was partly private projects. But they, you know, got huge amounts of money from the government and land grants to do that. And then that was in the 1860s. And then there was obviously the during the Great Depression, the New Deal had some big projects.
Right. And Tennessee Valley Authority. Yeah, I should have. I meant to phrase it as the last time, not the only time, the last time that we really seriously invested in our infrastructure was during the Great Society, which was like 50 years ago. Sure. So,
yeah. And then obviously, like, the federal highway system was built under Eisenhower right before the Great Society. So that's mm-hmm. another one that people think of a lot. And it, you know, to your point, though, about sort of these like emergency expenses, like the situation in Atlanta, they actually have a statistic on that as well, that it says that emergency expenses for deteriorating infrastructure repairs are close to $200 billion a year now, which I think is also a good number to compare against that, quote unquote, $40 billion investment proposal from the Saudis, just to like demonstrate that it's really nothing at all, because it's probably not even a one time, you know, it's probably spread out over a number of years. So it really doesn't, I mean, that, you know, barely covers anything at all. And we have the money and resources, we should be doing it internally in our own country. Although I know there's also proposals floating around to get some assistance for, you know, some of the financing long term from the Chinese government, which sort of makes sense, sort of doesn't make sense. It depends on how you look at it and what you're talking about specifically. But basically, the proposal there is that the Chinese really are concerned about the U.S. Economy and getting their money back from their various other investments and treasury bonds and things like that if the U.S. doesn't keep take care of itself. And they've also got a lot of money floating around in their investment banking systems that they would like to spend on things that are, you know, reliable investments like infrastructure, presumably would be, you know, if it's done through a loan and bond type structure, as opposed to like trying to have the private market do it. But also, Greg, on that first page of that proposal, you know, you were talking about kind of the problematic framing with regard to the creation of jobs. But again, we do want to emphasize this is a much better way of doing the plan than anything that, you know, Trump or the Republicans have floated. There are those there's four bullet points talking about kind of middle class jobs and other things like that. And why don't you walk us through sort of the details of like what the principles of execution would be on this Senate Democrats proposal on infrastructure?
OK, so the four bullet points that they have are one, buy America provisions to rebuild America with American products. A lot of American in there.
Basically, they don't want Chinese-made steel like how Trump does on his personal projects.
Right, right, right. We did that with the Transcontinental Railroad, and they decided, no, we're not going to do that again for whatever reason. I think that makes sense. Two, strong protections for working men and women like Davis-Bacon prevailing wages. Number three, strengthen participation of minority and women-owned businesses. And number four, accelerated project delivery while adhering to important environmental protections, which I think is probably something that really resonates with you, Bill.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, these projects are desperately needed and these investments are desperately needed. That doesn't mean that they should be like pouring concrete into wetlands or whatever, right. You know, but that there's a way of balancing to make sure that you're sticking within existing construction. And also, you do have to actually be careful because a lot of this involves literally pouring a lot of concrete and cement. And cement is a huge contributor to global warming, which a lot of people don't realize it. There's a lot of CO2 released as part of that process, and that's counted alongside things like transportation and other you know, major carbon dioxide producers. The other thing, though, is like, you know, these bullet points kind of underscore that even this Senate Democrats proposal that is so much better than what the Republicans have is more or less floating you know, a very outsourced way of handling this, which is not that surprising. I mean, that's how you would do it quickly. But like, you know, making sure that the contracts go to, you know, minority and women to own construction companies, at least in a proportional share, making sure that that you're paying prevailing wages. That means union wages, and not undercutting your existing construction, you know, jobs and things like that. Because I don't know right now off the top of my head, like what the situation is in the job market in general on that front. I don't know if, you know, that would be a serious risk of saying, okay, well, we're going to pay you less, but we'll give you guaranteed work for, you know, 6 months or a year or 2 years or something like that. That might create other consequences in that market. There's also kind of the problematic framing that they throw in about that the blueprint is fiscally responsible, which, fine, whatever, like I guess a lot of people want that, but it's fiscally irresponsible to not be investing, you know, trillions of dollars in our infrastructure when it's falling apart. So I'm a little less concerned about that. I would say this is an investment. I don't know that it needs to be like deficit neutral or whatever. This is a huge investment in our economy to make it work better. Rachel, they have a table there that kind of walks through what are some of the expenses within this $1 trillion, or not expenses, again, investments, I should say. How much money would be invested in particular areas of concern? Like, obviously, they mention, you know, roads and bridges, which we've been talking about. So what are some of the how much money are we talking about on some of these, and what are they?
So like we were talking about, roads and bridges would be $100 billion over the next 10 years. Revitalizing Main Street, so sprucing up core streets in towns and rural communities, that's another $100 billion. A really important one is water and sewer rehabilitation, $110 billion. Something that's near and dear to my heart is modernizing rail infrastructure. Idaho has none. We closed our only Amtrak station about 20, 25 years ago, and I would love for us to get back on the Amtrak system. So that would be $50 billion for rail infrastructure, and I would love to see rail come back to Idaho. $75 billion for rebuilding public schools. We've all read horror stories about mold in public schools, ceiling tiles falling on students, stuff like that. Modernizing our energy infrastructure. Again, we've read horror stories about how easily hackable our electric grid is, how far behind we are in energy infrastructure, expanding broadband into rural communities. That would be $20 billion. Idaho has the worst internet speed in the country because we have we are so rural. So broadband internet is not just a luxury anymore. Like, you have to have it for jobs, for education. So expanding that broadband service is so vitally important to our rural communities. Investing in public lands and tribal infrastructure, $20 billion. Apparently our national parks, I think there's a backlog on projects of about 10 years for national park revitalization. So that's fairly important. Modernizing VA hospitals, $10 billion. We've heard stories about VA hospitals and the service that is available there. So that's another super important project. And that I think that would get bipartisan support. Everybody loves to talk about supporting the troops, and that's something that would support the troops and get everybody on board.
Right. And then there is a final category, which is spelled out in more detail on page 11. And I don't know if you wanted to quote some of the statistics that they throw up there, some more American Society of Civil Engineers stats. And this addresses some of the questions, you know, because there's the $1.6 trillion right now that needs to be spent to get things to a current state of repair. There's a longer term horizon that they cite there. What are some of the numbers there?
So we would have to invest $3.6 trillion just to bring our existing infrastructure into good repair by 2020.
Well, and if we failed to do this, they're estimating $4 trillion in GDP loss from the economy, like that right. that we're just giving up for no reason, which I think really underscores the investment point that we keep making here, because even using the very flawed measurements of, GDP and things like that, the traditional capitalist economic measurements that don't take into account a lot of other ways of measuring the economy and the economy's health and things that we need to do in our society, even this is saying that failure to do this, to meet this, close this gap on the investment needs versus the actual investments, that's $4 trillion that you're giving up, and that's I think by 2020, which is very close now at this point. So that's like quite a lot of money. That's probably what, about $1 trillion of GDP given up a year, more or less. And then they do kind of end on the note there of like, that this blueprint is really only the starting point, that it has to be the starting point. It can't be the compromise position, because it's the starting point and everything else has to go beyond that in order to, meet that gap. But this is basically a quasi-emergency measure to really kick things off. Overall reactions to this plan, Rachel, we'll start with you.
Living in such a rural state like Idaho, we really need all of these projects, especially public transportation, which is basically non-existent, broadband, internet, public school investment. We desperately need all of these things, and it doesn't come from state funding. So we need that federal investment to really help reach a livable situation.
Greg, your thoughts on the plan?
I think just as we were going over it and as I've been reading it before the radio show, that the scope is, I think, more massive than people might think about when they think traditionally about infrastructure. I think a lot of times when people think about infrastructure, they just think about roads and bridges. And as Rachel listed earlier, the scope of this project is really, really, really massive, and there's a lot to do. So it is roads and bridges, but it's also waterways, and it's also water and sewage, and it's also public schools, and it's also hospitals, and it's also broadband infrastructure, and it's also electricity infrastructure and creating a better power grid and a more renewable energy source sourced grid. And so the scope, I think, is really, really, really massive. And that is, I think, probably why the American Society of Civil Engineers, because this project is so ambitious and because we need to do so many things in this country in order to get it up to par with infrastructure, that even this $1 trillion plan is still $1.6 trillion short of really what needs to be done.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's got to be the absolute minimum starting point. And it is sort of shocking that this is the Democratic counterproposal to just how bad of a plan is being floated by Trump and the Republicans. It is always sort of remarkable as well, just because, like, sure, I guess you can give away, like, essentially $1 trillion in tax credits that you're never going to get back or whatever, and, quote unquote, stimulate the private sector. But, like, fundamentally, they have to know that that's just not going to be enough to meet the needs. And no matter how, like, market libertarian you are as a Republican in Congress, like, you're just delusional if you think that you can get away with not funding these things and still have sort of a functional capitalist system, that they love so much. So many of their businesses and corporations really depend on having active, access to functioning, rail and highways and everything. And people don't even necessarily think about it, but if you have a business that, even if they produce everything overseas, their goods, and then they, bring them to the Walmarts of, America or whatever, a lot of that is being shipped, it comes in through a port, which often has some, public or private or both or whatever component to it, comes in through a seaport that requires various government investments, even if it's privately held. Then, they put it onto, they take the containers, put it onto a train, ship it halfway across the country or all the way across the country or, however far it needs to go. And then you, when you know, at a certain point they transfer it to a, you know, the highways, you know, through the trucking or through, you know, your Amazon delivery vans and things like that, that bring it that final mile to the person's house or whatever. You know, there's so much clear need that, like, the existing system we have just depends on this infrastructure functioning, that even if you're this, you know, kind of ruthless capitalist, the idea that you can just let this continue to fester and not do anything substantive about it is, I mean, it's not sustainable, even within that framework. We're going to go to a break now. When we come back, I want to kind of go back onto that point that Rachel and I were talking about regarding the need to sort of update the infrastructure financing to deal with the longer term horizon, you know, 2020 and beyond. There is a proposal that has been floated and is kind of alluded to in this proposal as well on that final page. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But basically, you know, after you've dealt with the sort of emergency situation, how do you make sure that we don't get ourselves back into this situation? How do we make sure that we're continuing to properly invest in and fund these infrastructure projects? So Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment from arsenalfordemocracy.com and WVUD. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, and still on the line with me from Idaho is Rachel, and on the line with me from Virginia is Greg. We've been talking this hour about infrastructure. Specifically, we were talking about the Senate Democrats' blueprint to rebuild America's infrastructure and create 15 million new jobs, which is a $1 trillion proposal to basically deal with emergency repairs needed immediately to get infrastructure back on track just in 2017. But as they said, it would take trillions more to get it back on track or keep it on track to just 2020, which is a few years from now. That's always a frightening thought to realize that 2020 is only a few years from now. But anyway, they did mention at the end of that proposal that there was going to be $10 billion, which is, you know, a fair chunk of change for what they're talking about. $10 billion out of the trillion would be to support the creation of new innovative financing tools aimed at unlocking capital and increasing infrastructure investment. And they specifically say to leverage additional funding and help drive greater investment into our nation's infrastructure. And again, this would be more long-term solutions rather than the immediate proposal here. We will invest in a new infrastructure finance entity like an iBank investment bank that would unlock pools of capital to provide low-cost loans or loan guarantees for appropriate projects across a broad range of sectors, including transportation, energy, affordable housing, and water infrastructure. It is estimated that the creation of such a fund with $10 billion in seed money could leverage over $100 billion in private investment over 10 years for infrastructure projects. Now, again, not 100% sure what they mean by that, because I don't know if they're trying to promote direct private investment in infrastructure or if they're saying we want to get private people with money to give us money that we can, you know, like in the form of issuing bonds or something like that, that we can use to finance these various investment projects. Now, if you are particularly leftist, you're probably not interested in hearing about this proposal at all. And I kind of agree. I am much more in the camp of let's just, you know, you raise some taxes or you raise some bonds, then you spend some money, you do direct employment if possible, do it, you know, as directly as you can through the government, make it industrial policy for infrastructure repair. However, the proposal here is more of a state capitalist proposal. If you don't know what state capitalism is, that's the term for when the state does things that the capitalist system, like they perform capitalism essentially instead of the private sector doing it. So it's, which that's been interesting too, because you've been getting a lot of like people calling everything socialist, like, you know, oh, that government owned thing is socialist and this government owned thing is social. That's not really exactly what socialism is. Like, this is more of kind of a social democratic state capitalism, I guess. But there is H.R. 547, which is probably what's being referenced, or at least something similar to that, in this Senate proposal. This is Representative Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, her bill that she's been introducing every session for a while now. But it actually, unlike some of those things that have, you know, they get introduced, you know, every 2 years and eventually people kind of stop co-sponsoring it or the numbers go up and down. There are 79 co-sponsors in the House on that. And it's a lot of pretty mainstream people because a lot of Democrats really do recognize the absolute need for getting infrastructure spending, not just on track now, but in the longer term. And so this is the H.R. 547 National Infrastructure Development Bank Act of 2017, or whichever year you're looking at. And the summary, if you want to look this up on congress.gov, it's a very handy place to look up kind of the details and summaries of legislation. It creates a wholly owned government corporation called the National Infrastructure Development Bank. It has a board of directors responsible for monitoring and overseeing energy, environmental, telecommunications, and transportation infrastructure projects. The board is authorized to, one, make loans and loan guarantees to assist in financing an infrastructure project, two, issue public benefit bonds and provide financing to infrastructure projects, and three, pay an interest subsidy to the issuer of American infrastructure bonds. Interesting point on that, actually. A lot of people who talk about infrastructure investment needs emphasize that now is like a really, really, really good time to do infrastructure investments because interest rates are so low right now. So that means that from the cost perspective of, you know, putting this together, you don't have to pay that much in, you know, in terms of interest. And that makes it a less expensive investment to make from the government's point of view. Although, again, we need to make it either way. So it doesn't really matter, but it happens to be a nice benefit. And then there's more details to the summary, but that is sort of the core important point here of how it would work is that similar kind of to the Federal Reserve, but a little bit different. Basically, just that you're creating this government-owned bank that can issue its own bonds. So private individuals, large or small, wealthy or not, who want to, you know, invest in America's infrastructure, which is a pretty reliable investment, as we discussed in the first segment. You can, you know, purchase some bonds, and then this bank will use that money that they raise through that, and that $10 billion in seed money, and they will, put together loans or loan guarantees, probably, I'm guessing, to states and municipalities for the most part. I'm guessing it's not going to be a whole lot of private companies getting those loans. Again, this is like kind of it's a state capitalist compromise. It's not like this is not really what socialism is or anything like that. But it is probably a step in the right direction under the current framework, and it's a fairly reasonable proposal, I think. I think in general, like I'm kind of, these are the kind of things that I support as a general matter, as much as possible, in addition to supporting, you know, direct government employment and spending on things. I do support, a lot more, state-owned corporations. Many countries that's seen as a very negative thing and gets phased out, or is being phased out. And in many cases, that's probably for the best there. But I think that it's perfectly reasonable to have state-owned corporations in the United States, because the government can do a lot of things by economies of scale, et cetera. But also it sometimes helps to be able to operate like a corporation, but without the same, shareholder type obsessions that typically would govern a normal corporation. It is very difficult for those corporations to make long-term infrastructural investments when they're supposed to be making a profit every single quarter and giving that back to the shareholders who are overwhelmingly very wealthy. So, Rachel, I know that you're just looking at this for the first time, but any sort of reactions to this this idea of seeding an infrastructure bank and setting up something like the DeLauro proposal?
Well, I think any step towards funding infrastructure projects is a step in the right direction. I was really heartened to read that there would be guidelines set forth to ensure diversification of lending activities by geographic region and infrastructure project type. So I think that it's good that all regions would benefit. Right now, it seems like the South, the Midwest, and the Mountain West kind of get short shrift on those types of projects. So ensuring that there would be an equality and diversification sounds like a step in the right direction.
Right. And one of the challenges, of course, is that typically, you know, the exaggerated example tends to be like Alaska, but also places like Idaho. Unfortunately, the population density is often relatively low in those places. So you get this kind of really ruthless cost-benefit analysis where they say, oh, I don't really feel like making this investment because it's not going to benefit that many people. But the problem is you need to make it, whether or not there's that many people. I mean, that's sort of the point that you were talking about in the first segment regarding like the internet infrastructure, which that's, I think, a big thing covered under telecommunications was mentioned in this infrastructure bank proposal summary. You know, I would very, very much like to see you know, government financing for municipally owned or county owned or whatever, or even state owned high speed internet, especially fiber optic internet. There are huge swaths of the country that have no fiber internet access at all, and huge swaths of the country that still don't even have normal broadband. And that's a huge problem that Democratic administrations since the 90s have been insisting they were going to get done once and for all. And then unfortunately, what they kept doing was just, you know, saying they were going to do public-private partnerships with the existing telecommunications companies, which then basically take the money and don't do anything, or they don't take the money, or there's various litigation right now in Massachusetts, I know, where companies like go bankrupt in the rural areas trying to provide internet and then say, well, now we don't have to provide internet at all. And it's like, but you can't just suddenly leave all these people with no internet access, because as Rachel said, you can't get by in society without it these days, especially once you've had it. You know, this public-private model is just not a good one for dealing with utilities like telecommunications infrastructure. That's something that we've talked about on past episodes, so I'll refer folks to those for more details on that. But the reality is that it would be great to have an infrastructure bank at the federal level that's financing state and municipally owned internet projects in places like Idaho. You know, get those like South Korea level internet speeds. But yeah, it would be really expensive and there's not a lot of customers and many of them are very spread out, but that's what the role of the government is. You know, that's why we have the big federal government in the first place, is because of all these rural states that we had, you know, where people needed services and support and things like that. And you know, that's how that kind of became a federal role. Greg, what is your reaction to this infrastructure bank proposal?
Well, I think a lot of the things that I was thinking, Rachel, and you both touched upon, this idea that these public-private partnerships, we talked a little bit about how they're not super efficient for doing things that might not necessarily yield a big investment, but or a big return on investment, rather. But the problem is that infrastructure as a whole is a public good. And like you were saying, the government really does need to do it. And obviously, this wouldn't be a radio episode without me, without bringing up what we're doing in public health right now. There's some concern that the Prevention and Public Health Fund is going to go away, which is basically this big pot of money that the government could use for prevention and public health. So we're trying to figure out like what could possibly replace that, and everything that, you know, is sort of on the table right now seems to be more like this, seems to be more these public-private partnerships. And again, just like the infrastructure, public health is also a good, and so or public good. And so it's very important that we're not dependent upon these our private partners to be interested in making an investment and getting a return on something in order for us to actually complete a project that needs to be done. And so I think definitely, as we were alluding to earlier, the better thing would be collect taxes, have a big pot of money, and then the government spends it how it sees fit and does infrastructure projects where necessary. And then also this pot of money gives people, the government, enough flexibility so that there, if there is an emergency, they don't have to go scrambling for some sort of private partner in order to contract to fix this emergency or what have you.
There's been various different ways over the years of funding various investment projects. You know, certainly you mentioned earlier in the episode about like the Tennessee Valley Authority and things like that. During the Great Depression, they actually mentioned, if you go to the text tab on congress.gov for any bill, you can read, in addition to like the details, there's usually a section called findings, which is where the whoever the sponsor is basically lists a bunch of reasons why they're doing the bill. It can verge onto the sort of propagandistic at some times, especially on Republican bills. But, you know, they mention here like the Erie Canal, the Transcontinental Railroad, the Hoover Dam, interstate highway system, things like that, where the U.S. has previously done things. I mentioned earlier about the Transcontinental Railroad, the way that that was kind of done, in addition to paying actual subsidies in terms of like per mile completed to the private companies. One thing that Lincoln authorized was this system where, so basically they stole a huge amount of land from the Native Americans. We know that. That's land expropriation, massive example of like expropriation, except from, instead of the powerful, from basically the least powerful people in the country. And then redistributed that. And in many cases, they redistributed it not just to, you know, little homesteaders on the prairie, as we know from Laura Ingalls Wilder libertarian propaganda stuff. Really what they were distributing it to was these giant corporations and their financial backers. Like each of these companies that were building the Transcontinental Railroad generally had like a financial arm associated with it to help with the project, and also to make sure that there was going to be demand for the railroads once they were built. So what the federal government did, as I recall, is that they, I don't remember if it was every mile or every certain number of miles, but basically every other section along either side of the railroad was given to the railroad corporation to sell off or build a town or whatever. And then every other one in between that was held, continued to be held by the federal government, so that the government would, you know, make money back essentially when that land became very sought after, because there was these burgeoning communities along the way. That's like a different way of having a government financing for a project like this. You're giving them this huge giveaway that's going to greatly increase in value, most likely, which it did. And so there's all kinds of ways of doing this. That's not the kind of direction that I would want to go in. I would certainly prefer that we be going in more of, if we have to choose between various systems like this, let's go with the infrastructure bank thing if we're not going to be doing it directly. Actually, interestingly, Greg, could you give us a couple of those statistics under point 5 and 6 from the findings section on this bill? Just to give us another kind of timeline and money required readout on infrastructure needs?
Sure. So one of them is that the Environmental Protection Agency projects that, let's see if I got this, that's 384,200,000,000 is needed to invest in infrastructure improvements over 20 years to ensure the provision of safe water, and 271 billion is needed for publicly owned wastewater systems related infrastructure needs over 20 years. That was a lot of zeros, so I had to count it. And then also, according to the Edison Electric Institute, the electric power industry will need to invest 298 billion in the nation's transmission system in the next 20 years in order to maintain reliable service. So this is a lot of money. This is a lot of updates. This is a lot of stuff that we need to do in the next two decades in order to have a functional infrastructure.
Yeah, and certainly electricity transmission is going to become a huge, huge issue, because the only way that we're going to get to a much cleaner energy economy and cleaner transportation economy is by converting a lot of things to electricity and making sure that our electricity is both highly efficiently delivered and generated cleanly, not by coal, not by natural gas. A sort of pet thing of mine for the past 10 years has been educating people on the issue of, sometimes you'll hear about like smart grids and things like that. That's a little bit kind of techie and overblown in some ways. You know, that's sort of like a Silicon Valley likes to push that kind of thing. The base reality is that it's a lot less about making sure you have some sort of computerized grid that efficiently distributes the power where it's needed. Certainly that's important. A big thing is that we transmit electricity over long distances. If you've been out anywhere out and about, you know, even a little bit into the countryside, you'll see these high tension, long range power lines that, you know, have those huge metal towers that are holding them up. And those tend to be, if I'm remembering the details correctly, those are alternating current, which loses 50% of the electricity along the transmission, right? So you're generating a huge amount of electricity at your, you know, coal-fired or natural gas-fired power plant or wherever, or your wind turbines or your solar panels, and you are losing 50% of what you've generated just in losses through the lines. That's the kind of like major upgrade that needs to happen, because think about it, if you can basically cut the need in half, you know, by just fixing that efficiency problem, then you get enormous carbon savings that help a lot with dealing with global warming. The problem is that think about how many thousands and thousands and thousands, probably millions of miles of transmission lines there are. There's various proposals. One of them is actually to convert to modernized DC current. That was kind of a thing back when electricity was quote unquote being invented, at least for the purposes of human harnessing. There was a sort of debate over whether or not to use AC or DC. And the problem at the time was that, you know, it didn't transmit very far, over those lines using the existing technology at the time. So they went with what ended up being better for long distance transmission, but not necessarily better in terms of how the technology would evolve. So now we have the technology to do it better than at the time when those paths diverged. And so that would require full scale kind of replacement of the grid. So that would be an enormous investment. That's well above and beyond the $298 billion that they're talking about there. But that would be an enormous help to getting us to, you know, clean vehicles, you know, any sort of future where you have automated electric vehicles providing freight and passenger transportation over our highway system is going to need both high-speed internet to provide the wireless, you know, instant data on you know, vehicles around you and traffic issues and things like that. It's also going to need a clean power grid to make sure that those cars are being and trucks are being powered in a responsible and clean manner, in addition to all of our other electricity needs. And then certainly, as you mentioned, all those billions for infrastructure improvements on waters and sewers. I think that's on a lot of people's minds right now because of the situation in Flint, Michigan, and that is all over the country. In many cases, it's final, you know, the final 10 or 15 feet or so is the problem. A lot of schools have problems with lead in the water because the outdated pipelines just from the street to the school. That's a smaller thing you can fix, but you multiply that over the many, 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 many numbers of schools that we have in this country, that becomes a large number. And then there's also just bigger things like Flint, where, you know, if you fail to maintain or properly supply your systems for delivering water over longer distances, that becomes a huge problem for people's health and safety. And then once you've made that switch, you can't go back because then the other thing is also polluted. And so, you know, these are numbers that are absolutely doable in terms of replacement, but they are large numbers. Especially if you're a municipality, you're going to really struggle to come up with this money on your own. So then you hopefully have the federal government's infrastructure bank, hypothetically, step in at that point. Oh, the other thing that they point out in this bill is, and this is where it gets into really, really questionable capitalism, state capitalism issues. They note the capital markets, including central banks, pension funds, financial institutions, sovereign wealth funds, and insurance companies, have a growing interest in infrastructure investment. The establishment of a United States government-owned institution would provide this investment opportunity to finance qualifying infrastructure projects, would attract needed capital for the United States infrastructure development. And that goes back to the issue of, like, you know, whether it's the Saudi sovereign wealth fund or the Chinese sovereign wealth funds, or maybe the Norwegians, I don't know. A lot of countries have these funds that can invest in various things, and they want stable, safe investments. It's better probably to be diverting them into within the capital market into a U.S. infrastructure bank or something like that, rather than having them like buying up, you know, land or housing speculatively as an investment property in the United States, which also happens, although generally from the individual level rather than the sovereign wealth fund level, just because if you have that, it's going to create other sorts of problems where you're sort of using up stuff speculatively. This is not speculative, obviously, right? If you're investing in infrastructure, it's going into something. And then, you know, the way that they get money back is that it was issued in the form of bonds with interest. So hopefully there's some way of making the money back to pay that interest. That's the part where I will admit I'm a little hazy on the details there, just because I'm not really an expert on that. But more problematically, than the sovereign wealth funds, though they have their own problems, certainly, is the mention there of pension funds, financial institutions, and insurance companies. And basically, that's them all figuring out where to stash money. Now, again, I would much rather have pension funds at the state and municipal level be invested in the government and in infrastructure rather than the stock market. But kind of if you're coming at it from any sort of leftist perspective, pension funds always the investment side of that can raise a lot of red flags. But people who are experts without a financial interest in diverting the money around generally say that, you know, having very safe, stable investment portfolios for pension funds that are not, you know, tied to the stock market, that are tied to really, really safe things like government bonds, things like that, that need to happen and are guaranteed very highly, that tends to be a better way of investing those things rather than trying to, you know, move things around to various stocks and companies that then create all sorts of problems, right? I'd rather have us be invested in fixing the highway with our pension dollars or our, you know, college, huge fund than having it be invested in like oil companies and things like that. Cause there's a lot of institutions, pension funds and colleges that are invested in, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline or Keystone XL or whatever, which I guess those are infrastructure, but they're not the kind of infrastructure that I would like.
Yeah. Just a quick note on pension funds. The state of Idaho, PERSI, which is Public Employee Retirement, something. We actually weathered the 2008, recession a lot better than most private funds did. So I'm wondering what we did invest in, and maybe that would, like, an infrastructure bank would be something that we would invest in and hopefully get a good return on. That's my selfish want.
Well, I think that's a fair and reasonable thing to want. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us this week to talk about the U.S. infrastructure needs and the Senate blueprint proposal from the Democrats.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
And Greg, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me, as always.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.